It's often those power-grabbing, egomaniacal behaviors are people trying to reinforce a weak ego with power structures. And so then they build around themselves a whole bunch of things that punish anybody that would challenge their worldview. Whereas somebody who has a healthy ego, if you disagree with somebody with a healthy ego, they go, well, that's interesting. Tell me more. They don't feel that personal threat.
Welcome to Evolve Leadership, the arena where high-achieving leaders are challenged to redefine their limits. My name is Angus Nelson. I grew up in the United States, and I now live in Lisbon, Portugal. I'm an executive coach, and I've spent my career advising and training leaders from startups to Fortune 500 companies. And here's what I've learned. An old, ineffective leadership framework will always keep you on a hamster wheel, consumed with work-life balance, burnout, and stress. Here on the show, each week we'll help you rethink the path to achievement. We'll help you discover new principles, new philosophies to the modern leader. Look, the world is relentlessly changing, demanding a new era of leaders. It's time to redefine your limits. So enter the arena, my friend. It's time to evolve. Welcome to the Evolve Leadership Show. I'm your host, Angus Nelson. Today, we are going to be talking to someone that I met through another friend who's also been on the show. Jennifer Hill introduced me to this man. And today on the show, we're going to jump into his expertise, which is all about leadership. In particular, he's got a book that he just released recently, and he's got a whole premise around the concept of self-leadership we're going to talk about today. In addition, we're going to dive into a little bit of how our biases are oftentimes the conflict for better leadership. I'm excited for you to hear the show because I think it's really going to dive into the heart of what I would love to make transferable and contagious in listeners like you. Please welcome to the show, Andrew Bryant. Let's jump into that interview right now. Well, hey there, Andrew. Welcome to the show.
A pleasure to be here, Angus.
Here we are talking, and we're using virtual technology, and yet we're only like miles away here in Portugal.
Yep. The expat community in Portugal.
Look at brings us together. So I want to ask you immediately going into this, the premise for your book was coming out of COVID, so much has changed in leadership, in team building culture, as well as even, you know, office engagement. Talk to me about how you observed the emphasis for your newest book. How did that come into play?
Well, the book was actually commissioned by one of my Silicon Valley clients. I was the coach to the CEO and the executive leadership team, and I got them to collaborate as a team to practice self-leadership amongst themselves and to be creative and innovative and to live the vision and mission of the organization. I think the executive leadership team, you know, they have to live the values. Otherwise, if they just print it on the walls, it's a waste of time and space. So the chief people officer said, this has been great. You've helped the team come together. I want to cascade this through the organization, particularly we're now in lockdown. How do our managers engage people and be self-leaders? Would you write us a book? And I said, well, having already written three books, how much money have you got? Because I know how long it takes.
Come on.
And they told me, and I said, well, that isn't enough. But I tell you what, if I hang on to the IP and we work with, you know, some case studies within your organization, I'll give you the employee handbook that you want or the leader's handbook you want, and I'll get something on the other side. So The new leadership playbook came out of that. So these were my ideas, theory, thought leadership about self-leadership in organization, and the chief people officer saying, yeah, but I need this dumbed down into a something that my managers can apply straight away. Yeah. So it's a very pragmatic book, so hence the word playbook. Although after writing the book, I think each play is actually a conversation. I came away through this process of writing this book is realizing that leadership is a conversation. It's a conversation one-to-one, and it's a conversation one-to-many. And people didn't have great conversations face to face between leader and manager and employee. And through COVID and virtual, it was even worse. And so the need for his 12 of the conversations that you're going to need to have at some point, and here's how to have them.
And you also talked about in there, and I think this probably has a lot to play with that, you know, this concept of influence, right? You have executive presence, and there's a bunch of different points that you unpack within the book. And sometimes when people hear influence, they think manipulation, they think coercion, they think all these negative things. Can you unpack like your philosophy around how influence plays in leadership?
Sure. So, I mean, I think it was John Maxwell that said, you know, leadership is influence. I actually spent 17 years in Asia, and I got engaged by a number of companies to teach influence. In fact, Microsoft engaged me to teach influence without authority across Asia. And I hit a wall because there was a real resistance to the term influence in Asia, because they were equating influence with manipulation. And we know that manipulation is bad. So I went to the dictionary. I mean, obviously, I'd studied Cialdini, and he talked about influence and persuasion. And even then, I thought there was a distinction between influence and persuasion. But the dictionary doesn't really help. It doesn't make a clear distinction, but I thought there really was. And I was struggling with a class of managers one day, and I said, look, I pulled a chair out in the front of the room, and I grabbed one of the managers and physically dragged him and put him in the chair. Now, I wouldn't do that today. I'd probably get canceled. I was getting really frustrated. I'm a big guy. You know, I grabbed this guy and pulled him in the chair, and I said to everybody, you all right? He said, yeah, I'm all right. I said to the class, did I influence him? And they went, absolutely not. You know, you abused him, you manipulated him. And I said, isn't it interesting that the word manipulation actually has the same root as manhandling, right? So, yeah. So clearly manipulation is force.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, well, then how would I get him from where he was, point A, to where we needed him to be, point B? And they started to offer all these incentives. You know, you could offer him money, a promotion, you could offer him a holiday. You know. And I went, is that really influence or is that persuasion? Because we've all been persuaded, you know, come to my party on Friday night. Oh, sorry, I'm busy. Oh, no, please come to my party on Friday night. You know, it won't be the same unless you're there. Please, please, please. And you go, okay. And you unwillingly go, but you go. Mm-hmm. So I feel persuasion is sort of a softer force, but it's still force.
Yeah.
So I said, but the question is, how would I willingly get him? You know, how do I, without paying him, without incentivizing him? And they were stuck. And I said, well, what if it was important for him to sit in this chair? What if we knew that he valued education and we said, look, we need to demonstrate influence and we need a volunteer that believes in learning and education. And, you know, we would need that person to sit in this chair. And he said, I'd be here in a flash. And I said, so clearly influence is a willing yes. Persuasion is a reluctant yes. And manipulation is a forced yes.
I love that. And I like to think of it as kind of like inspiration. Like, how do you inspire someone for an activity, an action, a belief, especially when you're culture building? You know, influence is like, how do you give them a reason and a why for that belief or for that motivation, for that action? Would you agree?
Well, I agree. And again, you know, the etymology of the word inspire is from inspiration, right? To take a breath, you know, and to breathe in the spirit. So the continuum from manipulation to influence, if we put them on a continuum, influence through persuasion to influence, what is the variable in that continuum? And this for me was obvious because I'd written 3 books on self-leadership. Yeah. And it is that it's a level of control. If somebody forces me to do it, they put a gun to my head, I have to do it or I give up my life, then I'm forced. I have no control. If I'm persuaded, I'm reluctantly giving up my autonomy. But if I'm influenced, it feels like it's my idea. And, you know, I'm married to a very intelligent and strong woman. And so if she wants me to do something, she tries to make it my idea. And then it's going to get done, right? And I don't want to get canceled for some kind of gender stereotyping. This is my experience. But yeah, it might resonate with a few of your listeners.
No, married people, we can't relate to that at all. No. But, you know, along that same line, you know, the element of trust, the element of, again, that inspiration, like, I always say, like, when things get in trouble, you know, and there's uncertainty, when there's ambiguity, some of the best things a leader can do is cast vision. Because if people see where they're going, that inspiration, that influence gives them that cause, that why, that participation, that collaboration, and some of the stuff that you talk about throughout the book, especially the collaboration, ownership, you know, and these kinds of areas that stir someone to a passion. One piece that's in this, in influence, that you talk about, I want to dive into is bias. Because as we are influencing our teams, as we are leading our companies, oftentimes we don't know what we don't know, and we are filtering everything through stories that we've created in our own head, good, bad, indifferent, what have you. And you have a whole section just on biases. Can you kind of unpack that a little bit on how bias plays into our leadership?
Well, we're all biased, right? I mean, if you've heard of the book, and I'm sure you have, Daniel Kahneman's book, Think Fast and Think Slow. He won a Nobel Prize for his work on bias. And he was famously said, after 40 years of studying bias, I know that I'm still biased. So, you know, the way the brain works, we know with neuroanatomy and neurophysiology, the brain is wired for shortcuts. And a bias is a mental shortcut. This is the simplest way of thinking about it, is I don't want to have to think too hard, because the brain uses up 25% of your calories, right? So if I can do a mental shortcut, if this looks like the right answer and it works, then I don't have to do too much processing. If I have to work out the nuance of everything, that's energy exhaustive. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned the most famous in my mind, or maybe it's not the most famous, but my favorite bias. You mentioned the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is we don't know what we don't know. We're ignorant of our own ignorance. You know, yeah. We don't know. We're stupid. We assume we know more about a subject than we actually do. And you know, if you say to somebody, "Do you know how a ballpoint pen works?" And they go, "Of course I do." And they go, "Well, explain it to me." "Do you know how a helicopter works?" "Yeah, of course I do." "Explain it." And they don't. Yeah. So we assume we know an awful lot. And there's this incredible bias that we have as leaders, that we have a mental picture about the way things should happen. Hmm. Right? This is the way to do the work properly, right? And so we think we have communicated this to somebody else and they should just get it. And that's two shoulds. And you can see that we're going to should all over ourselves, because if you've ever, as a manager, delegated a piece of work and you've asked the person you've delegated it to, "Do you understand?"
Yeah.
What do they always say? "Well, they always say yes." Then I ask you, "Well, do they understand?" And the answer is, of course, no.
Yeah.
Except they do understand. They understand what they understand. A communication is from one mental model or mental schema to another person's mental model and schema. And both are narratives that are based on past experiences and upbringing and language even. And, you know, yesterday I was running a masterclass and I had somebody from Luxembourg, somebody from Switzerland, somebody from Iceland, somebody from Norway. And actually we were discussing the cultural nuances between Nordic countries.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can say something, you'd think, well, the Norwegians and the Swedes are all Vikings, but no, it's different. Mm-hmm. And Finland is different again. And so you say something very simple, like, "Go out and buy me a sofa." Anybody goes, "You understand sofa, you know, sofa, settee, you know, the thing you sit on." And I go, "Yeah, I get it." And then you ask, "Well, what are they going to come back with? How many people can sit on the settee? What color is it? What is it made of?" Mm-hmm. And it's one word. You try and articulate an abstract concept, the vision, and everybody's got a different mental picture.
Yeah.
And getting through that, as you know, asking the question, which most people go, "I know you understand, but I'm just curious, what is it you understand?"
Yeah. I had this situation arise with some of my team members, one in particular, where I was like, "Oh, I want to do this thing. So let's do it." Yeah, I did it. And he brings it back, you know, to me, and I'm like, "That is not what I had in mind at all. Like, no, I'm so sorry. Like, this is a waste of your time, waste of my time, blah, 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 blah." I mean, I didn't confront it that way. I didn't make him feel like an idiot. I just said, "It's my bad, because it's leadership problems are my problems." I didn't articulate an expected outcome. And I've learned I don't have to tell them how to do what they do. I want them to surprise me with their ingenuity, their creativity, their genius. That's their role in how. But what is the expected outcome? I know Dan Martell One of my coaches had stated, you know, when you want something done, you have to paint what does the outcome look like? I want it to look like this, feel like this, be like this. But how it actually gets there is not nearly as important as does it meet this expectation? And expectations is another like theme that weaves throughout your book too.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there was a low-hanging fruit there because as you've read the New Leadership Playbook, you know that there's a framework in there that I use as a diagnostic for every conversation and interaction. And that is clear expectations times mindset and motivation, right? Times right behaviors equals results.
Yeah.
And let's face it, in a you know, post-pandemic, pre-pandemic, we're still measured on results. If you don't deliver results, it doesn't matter if your people love you, your tenure will be limited. So we're all measured by results. We're in commercial situations. But if you drive those results at the expense of your people, your tenure will also be limited. We've had the great resignation. And if you can't hire and maintain good talent, you can't be competitive. So this overcoming the bias by setting clear expectations, and that has to be a dialogue.
Yeah.
And particularly virtual. There was a piece of research done during the pandemic on virtual platforms. So a lot of people pivoted, you know, whether they were using Slack or they're using Yammer or whatever methodology they were using. Only 8% of leaders were dialoguing. 8%. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was broadcasting.
Yeah,
you and I are having a conversation. It goes backwards and forwards. It's an exchange of ideas, and creativity can, you know, new ideas can come out of that. But if I just broadcast at you, I'm only getting monochrome. And so only 8%. Now, face-to-face people are better, but that's what the opportunity was. How do we create a dialogue with people? Because people aren't engaged if they're not part of the process, and you're not going to pick up their bias or their mindset, their motivation, if you don't dialogue. And all of this, in my opinion, and I think most people would agree with me, is mute if it doesn't result in a behavior. So you might say, well, if I influence somebody, I change their mindset. But does that really matter unless it changes a behavior?
Yeah.
And because it's the behaviors that drive results. So we have to have expectations, we have to have mindset and motivation, and we have to have behaviors. And so if we're not getting results, it'll be one of those three.
One of those things, can I jump
in?
Yeah,
sure. I'm sorry. And we knew this was going to happen, that since you asked me about a book I wrote and spent a lot of time researching, I was going to go off on my hobby horse. So stop me, please.
Well, I want to jump into one of the things that you said was, the motivation, right? And this is this. Well, we're kind of like following this interesting arc. We have this bias and those biases, I've worked for one guy who loved to hire people like himself. Even though I started the company with him, I was nothing like him. And that's kind of our yin and yang, what made us great. I was a people person. I handled all the collaboration for our innovation association. And my colleague was more of the analytical. He was the research guy, and he was connected to all the big brands, blah, 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 a great team. And then everyone we built after that was all more on the analytical side. And it started to skew what was to be a people focus, type of organization into facts, figures, dotting I's, crossing T's, and getting things into these systems and processes. That bias played into some challenges within the company. Because you start to hire people like yourself because you like people like yourself. And then you think that people make decisions for the same reason that you make decisions, or they have behaviors in the same way that you would behave. And if they do this thing, then if you did that same thing, you would say, well, that's why I'm doing that. So that must be why they're doing that thing too, good, bad, or indifferent. And all these things play into crazy worlds. If we don't recognize, if we stand back and say, hey, what is the strength and skill we need for this role, even if that person doesn't necessarily be like me, as an example?
Hopefully, as we mature, we recognize that our way is not necessarily the right way, and that there is nuance. The research on teams, you'd be aware of, obviously, the huge research that Google did, and they found the number one thing for an effective team was psychological safety, that people had the ability to speak up and say, well, I have a different opinion. The challenge with always hiring people like you, and I mean, look, I was coaching one manager and he was complaining about somebody else. He said, yeah, this guy said, yeah, I hire different people. I've hired people from Harvard and from MIT. That was his diversity. You know, he'd hired somebody outside of Harvard. Yeah, there's some work you can do around this. I mean, bias when it comes to personality. So personality is a bias, is what I'm trying to say. You know, do I have a bias for details or a bias for big picture? Do I have a bias for seeking my energy from a group, or do I have a bias for seeking my energy privately, right? So bias and personality are linked. And it's really useful with a team. You know, I do a lot of work with executive leadership teams to run a psychometric on the team and then map that to the whole team. And you'll find that a lot of the team is a cluster. You know, if it's a sales and marketing team, you know, there's going to be a real bias to extroversion and directness. If it's, you know, accounting, you're going to get a high bias towards conscientiousness. But you'll always have that outlier. And in your case, you were the outlier, the people person. And when you get the group together and say, well, look, you know, there's 9 of you in the team, you know, 7 of you are like this, and 1 of you is like this, and 1 of you is like this. Why are those outliers important? Because they recognize when you're about to drive off the bridge, or they're generating the new ideas and the rest of you are executing the ideas. Yeah. So it's valuing the difference that is so important. And look, I'm version 6.2 of myself, which is my cute way of saying I'm 62. And version 6.2 has a lot less hair than version 4.2.
Yeah.
But version 6.2 has a lot more wisdom and empathy. Over the last 20 years, I particularly mapped it over the last 20 years, you know, because I was successful by the time I was 40, but I was doing it my way. And then I hit the wall big time. And that's when I had the epiphany around, hang on a moment, you know, I'm working harder and harder and harder to do the same thing because I'm obviously clearly there's a huge blind spot. And that's when I started to recognize that certain parts of my personality were not helping me. They're actually, it was a strength, but a strength overplayed becomes a weakness. 100%. And I think you will know, you know, as a coach, you will bump into this all the time with senior leaders. And they said, but I've done this and it got me to a C-suite position, or I did this and it got me to the head of department. Therefore it must be right. And you go, well, it got you this far, but it's not going to get you all the way. And Marshall Goldsmith wrote a book with that title, which I think is the world's best title for a book, is What Got You Here Won't Get You There, right?
Before we continue, I want to acknowledge something important. By listening to this show, you are taking a step that many leaders are frankly unwilling to do, and that is invest in yourself. And to honor your commitment, we want to invest in you. Our research shows that elite leaders excel in 6 core areas, and we've developed a quick 2-minute assessment to help you highlight your strengths, uncover your blind spots, and see how you stack up against other top leaders. You'll get a personalized report that pinpoints the areas you can address to evolve into that next level leader. So, to see where your leadership stands, go to rankmyleadership.com. Now, back to the show.
When you faced that yourself and you made that recognition, had even the self-awareness, which is a whole nother conversation we could have on another day, or lack thereof in leadership. But for you, when that clicked in, what was working before isn't working now. Like, what was one of those pieces that, you know, hit you in the face, kicked you in the nuts, punched you in the gut, and said, you can't do this anymore?
Well, for me, it was losing a business through a business disruption, not seeing it coming, being $300,000 in debt and living in a backpackers hostel in the red light district of Sydney, and you know, gone from successful to having lost a marriage, lost a business, lost my self-esteem, lost my dream, and fundamentally thinking, well, I'm going to drink myself to death now. And then waking up and going, hey, I'm not quite ready to die. I've got to put it all back together. So I have a rag to riches story again, in that, you know, I lost it all and I went, okay, what's really important? And I went and sat on, I climbed up the Blue Mountains in Sydney and sat there and I walked, you know, what do I do? And interestingly, I'd had an offer to go back and do the same thing, but as an employee. And I went, well, that'll solve my short-term income issues, but I'm going to be miserable. And I thought, well, what do I really care about? And this epiphany that I had, I went, well, you know, like many people, I had the epiphany, everybody else needs to have this too. Mm-hmm. So that started me on the journey of researching, writing about self-leadership.
Damn, dude, we need to like have a deeper conversation because our stories align in many ways. And it is a story of resilience that, again, part of some of the stuff that you do is understanding that until you've been through challenge, and I see this in a lot of startups, and I'd love for you to kind of expound on this, is some of these young guys experience, young girls experience, you know, immediate success, but then the moment something goes sideways, they fall apart like a $2 suitcase because they haven't been through something. What are some of the ways that you speak into those situations?
There's a concept that we have as human consciousness is that we're able to go meta. Meta, you know, gives us the word metaphor. It means to go above and beyond. So when you look at resilience, if you interview people that have been through some level of pain and discomfort, as obviously both of you and I have, is they will describe this moment of sort of an out-of-body experience of looking down at themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you know, as a wise person once said, this too shall pass. Right. And those people are resilient, have zoomed out to their present situation. It's like Stoic philosophy, facing the brutality of today's reality without losing the faith that you will succeed or prevail. And so when we're in a disaster, a critical situation, it all feels very personal. It feels very pervasive. It's about everything, and it's going to be permanent. But resilient people have a moment where they zoom out and go, well, this is now, but this doesn't define me forever. Mm-hmm. And that is the key quality of resilience, is to zoom out of that. Because then we have to break some of our biases and our identity, because we've identified as a success. Now we're not a success, right? And we see people, you know, in the current political climate, it's very easy to spot people who have clearly identified with their wealth or people who have clearly identified with a position.
Yeah.
And when you have to then find out who you are other than the money or other than the position and the title, I mean, getting fired is a massive, it destroys a lot of people because their ego was so attached to the title and the climb, the fall goes, well, who am I without this position?
Yeah.
Resilient people go, yeah, that isn't really who I am. There's something more to me than that, and I will overcome this. And that's my view on resilience. Resilience is the ability to bounce back or bounce forward is a better term for human resilience. You don't bounce back to what you were before. You bounce forward to a new and better version of yourself.
Come on. So you brought up something about the political climate, and I'm just going to tap into this real quick. And I don't mean this from a political
aspect. Don't get me canceled. Don't get me canceled.
I'm not talking about like we don't have to talk about particular countries or leaders, but I want to take this and transcend this into leadership. So in politics, in business, in corporate, in startup, in venture capital, in equity, in M&A, like all those different roles, so many people who rise to the ranks are often from a place of more of an ego or political play, not so much of a character authenticity play. Those are fewer and fewer and harder to find. Fortunately, thank goodness, that's changing. But when we see some of these plays where someone who has self-respect, loves their family, dare not want to put themselves out onto the platform because of the criticism that they might face in some of those roles. So we have a vacuum where sometimes toxic leadership is rising to the ranks. How do we fix that?
Well, that is the billion-dollar question. The system is broken because the system rewards behaviors that are self-centered and short-term. you know, the I'm trying to think. I think it was, yeah, I can't remember who said it, but it, distrust those people who want leadership positions. You know, your best leaders are reluctant leaders, right? Because anybody who wants it for the power and the recognition is the wrong person to do it. Yeah, I mean, be very suspicious of people because, as a, you know, the ego is an identity with, you know, it links to power. And particularly egocentric behaviors. In fact, you know, from a self-leadership perspective, a healthy ego is a good thing. Yeah. It's often those power-grabbing, egocentric behaviors, egomaniacal behaviors, are people trying to reinforce a weak ego with power structures. And so then they build around themselves a whole bunch of things that punish anybody that would challenge their worldview. Mm-hmm. Whereas somebody who has a healthy ego, if you disagree with somebody with a healthy ego, they go, well, that's interesting. Tell me more. They don't feel that personal threat. Mm-hmm. And this is why I focus so much on the practice of self-leadership, which is the practice of intentionally influencing your thinking, feeling, and actions towards your objectives, which requires self-awareness, self-regulation or self-motivation, and self-learning, because then you go, okay, well, you disagree with me. Tell me more. What's that about? Because it doesn't impact me. And I don't, you don't need power or wealth, you know, to succeed. One of the things I noticed when I was in Asia was that there was always a lot of very nice cars outside of hotels, you know, Maseratis and Lamborghinis. And my company is registered in Dubai, and that's even that's more prevalent. And you will witness the guy in the Lamborghini, the Maserati, drive outside the hotel, rev the engine, get out, throw his keys to the valet. And I'll often ask an audience, big ego or small ego? And most people will say big ego. And I actually say, no, it's the reverse. It's a small ego. If you have to show your power, your ego is fragile. If you can turn up in jeans and a t-shirt, I mean, you notice Zuckerberg doesn't show his wealth, right? He turns up in jeans and a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Doesn't need to. But, you know, you see the new wealthy with their Gucci belt and Louis Vuitton man bag, then, you know, that's that kind of peacock display often shows an insecurity. I don't know whether have I answered your question or have I gone on a rant?
I think you've got a little bit of everything, and I'm not mad about it. I'm not mad about it.
So how do we fix it? Well, look, you know, it was a distraction because how do we fix it? We create structures where, you know, people who have virtue, and so self-leadership and Stoic philosophy are, you know, self-leadership is a modern Stoicism, is that you want people who want to live a good life. You know, the Stoics believed in eudaimonia, living a good life, a life of virtue, a life of integrity. You know, if we had societies that were valuing telling the truth and owning up to mistakes and demonstrating that we were human and learning from those mistakes and doing it better, if we have a society that recognizes and values and celebrates that, as opposed to a society that believes in power and personality, then we would fix it.
Yeah. Oh, so much work to be done. That's why we do what we do and why there needs to be more of us helping do what we do. Right?
Yeah.
Never going to be without a job, and I don't think AI is going to take over for it. So
no, AI won't, because AI won't challenge the leader, right? So, you know, I think the value of being a C-level confidant or executive coach is that if you have that agreement with the coachee, you know, you say, look, if you start losing it, do I have permission to call you out on it?
Yeah.
And they'll often say yes at the beginning. When you actually do call them out, there's one of two things happens. They either grow or you get fired.
Yeah.
I've had both experiences. I've been fired by a C-level leader when I called them out, and I said, look, you know, I think you're taking a step backwards. You know, you've made a great deal of progress, but I think this is not that. And I got fired the next day. So yep. It happens, right?
Yeah. And that comes with the territory, and it's a learning for them and a learning for you.
I mean, the learning for me was, would I do it again? And I think, yeah, I would. I mean, I think It's very easy as a, if you've got money and power, to get sycophants around you and who will tell you how wonderful you are. Yeah. You know, I like working with clients who go, I want you to hold me accountable. I want you to hold me to a better standard. Yeah. Because I am prepared to be fired, I can tell them the truth and they know it.
Yeah. There's a saying that I've embraced that says, something effective, that which will offend you the most has the most power to transform you.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Right? Or let me reframe it another way. That which has the most power to transform you will at first offend you. That's the quote.
Yes.
Right?
It will.
And so when we hear something and we feel that rise, and it, all of a sudden you got to check yourself, like ego, check your bias, check your all the different things of self-awareness, check your like, where are you coming from? And then you realize, oh yeah, that was a dick move. You know, like, oh yeah, okay, you're right. Okay, my bad.
You know, one of the things I said about changing is people are willing to make a mistake. And you know, you heard me call myself version 6.2, and of course, it led to a joke about my lack of hair. And of course, on this conversation, it's we're
mutual.
We're like
good company.
We're like headed on that one rather than like minded. But think about myself rather than an age as a version is a good mental model for me, because I know I'm always improving. And I know I'm not there yet. You know, here is the test to see if you've reached enlightenment. If you're still here, you haven't, yeah. Right? So, if we can all just accept each other as work in progress, and that's the biggie, right? Mm. Because with self-leadership, you develop self-awareness, and with self-awareness, you get better other awareness. You get more empathetic. You realize that, hey, I've been on a journey and I've made mistakes and I've learned from those mistakes and I'm getting better. Therefore, I should give other people the benefit of the doubt that they're doing the same thing. Mm. And one of the things that if I look back in my younger self, the thing that I regret the most is not seeing where somebody else was at, just going, they didn't perform or they didn't do what I wanted them to do, but not knowing where they were at in their life or their journey, what was going on for them. Mm-hmm. That I'm trying to get better at. You know, whenever something's happening, I'm going, well, what's happening for you? What's behind that? Yeah. And doing that before I react, that's my work in progress. And, you know, I would share everybody, if we all did that a bit more, the world would be a better place.
Yeah, 100%. Speaking of what we were talking about before in marriage, all the times, right, that we do things and then in hindsight, maybe not the best thing. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. Maybe I should have sighed. Maybe I shouldn't have rolled my eyes, like all these different things. But to your point, you know, one of my biggest regrets was that I knew enough about my own potential and transformation, but stayed small. Like I didn't allow myself to step into what I knew I was capable. Because early in my career, I got shut down a couple of times, and then I became afraid of my own light. On one hand, I got used. Well,
Marianne Williamson wrote a poem for you, didn't she?
Oh, gosh.
Our greatest fear, right?
I just read it yesterday, yep.
Our greatest fear is not our darkness, but our light. Who am I to be amazing and wonderful? Yeah. I'm paraphrasing, of course.
Yeah, and absolute truth, right? It's like when I realize, by the way, I just got goosebumps because that piece of writing is so powerful and so necessary for people. I think even specifically today, coming out of COVID, and this is a great kind of like bring us in full circle, is coming out of COVID and recognize that you have the potential to be and to do whatever it is that you choose to want and to be. And that coming out of where we saw death and destruction and deceit, depending on which side of the aisle you want to be on, like everybody has an opinion. And that's why I'm in Portugal. Like life is too short. What do I want to create?
Sure.
What do I want to be? What do I want to do?
You know, I mean, there may be a caveat around, could we be everything we'd want to be? I mean, at 62 years old, it's unlikely I'm going to be a world championship jockey. Firstly, you know, I'm too old, I'm not fit enough, I'm too heavy, and I'm allergic to horses. So I would probably say, you know, I put a caveat, but, you know, is there potential that I've not yet reached and the people that I speak to is there, you know, can you create the world around you? You know, it's the great nature and nurture debate, right? So yeah, we don't get to choose our DNA. We don't get to choose our parents and our early upbringing and nationality. And a lot of people don't get to choose their religion or the football team they follow because it was just pre-programmed. They think it's free will, but it's not.
Yeah.
But the wake up moment, the epiphany that you have at some point that, you know, okay, all everything that happened up until now was potentially programmed by circumstance. But the moment I set an intentionality that I'm going to start growing and becoming what I want to be, that I can upgrade the version with the strength of my will and my intentionality by taking action towards an objective, I can make a difference. That belief, whether it's real or not, operates as if it is real.
Yeah.
And we have to live our lives that way. You know, if anything I tell younger people, because I've had in 2021, in the midst of the pandemic, they thought I had cancer and removed half of my insides. Only to find out that it was a benign mass after they'd removed it, you know, a significant chunk of my bowels. And this was in COVID, and I got a, you know, I got a post-surgical infection and thought I was going to die. And the diagnosis, I thought I was going to die. And then I came out and I was still alive. I was like, OMG, you know, let's not sweat the small stuff. Let's live every day. And then recently I've been told I have a huge blockage in the widowmaker artery in my heart, and I could die today, or I could live till I'm 80. Now, you know, there's some things I can do that might give me a better chance, which of course I'm doing. But just you know, if at 20, you know, at 25, if I'd had that sense of I shouldn't really be wasting today, and if anybody young is listening to this, right, don't wait until you know, you get those kind of bad news to say, well, I really need to use this day. But that's certainly how I look at it.
And I think, you know, in this whole leadership context, it really kind of boils down to some of the same element is we're building something that needs to be bigger than us.
Yes.
And if we make it about us, we're always going to get in our own way. But if we make it about the vision and the people around us, we have a far greater potential for success. And I want to bring this in for a landing, sorry, but I'll give you the last word.
I got a sense that you were going to wrap up here, but the word for that is legacy.
Yeah,
when's the best time to plant a tree? Well, 25 years ago, and the next, you know, would you plant a tree today if you knew that you were going to die next week?
Yeah,
and that's what we're doing is planting a tree now.
Yeah. So if you haven't picked up on what we're putting down, the new leadership playbook. Being human whilst successfully delivering accelerated results with Andrew Bryan. Andrew, I want to leave us with one more quote, actually not from this book, from your book, Self-Leadership. And when I was doing my research and I stumbled across this and you said that it's your life. Self-leadership is about being in the driver's seat and living authentically. And when you find your self-leadership is inspiring others, you will be more motivated to keep doing more. And from the words of Dr. Seuss in the book, Places You Will Go, you have brains in your head, you have feet in your shoes. You can steer yourself in any direction you choose. Thanks so much for being with us, Andrew.
Thanks for doing your research, and it's been a pleasure, Angus.
As we wrap up another episode of Evolve Leadership, thank you so much for taking time to invest in you. If there's to be any sustainable growth in your company or even in your relationships, you must grow first. And it's what I love to do for leaders, to help them grow, to challenge their thinking, sharpen self-awareness, to instill an unshakable confidence, and ultimately upgrade their sense of self. And we do this through our proprietary method called Agile EQ Plus, where we're leveraging agile leadership and emotional intelligence. We provide our signature training for individuals, and for businesses, we've designed a unique curriculum for company-wide learning and development. If you'd like to learn more about our training or to schedule a call, you can simply go to evolveleadership.org. And until next time, stay driven, keep climbing, and never stop evolving.